House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 25th, 2011. First item on the agenda is a work session on House Bill 2312. Mr. Taylor.
Committee, House Bill 2312 comes in from Representative Tomei. It provides that charitable corporations are not liable for damage arising and providing ear glasses, eyeglasses, hearing aids, or other medical devices. Chair members of the committee, unfortunately today, because despite some problems with the computer, we are unable to get information to LFO to get the fiscal impact statements back. But we do have several sets of amendments on this and other bills here. And I received last night from Representative Tomei, the day before it was the Dash 4 amendments, that basically says it would limit this to a fraternal organization, I'm looking at the Dash 4, that is also a charitable corporation, and that is affiliated with a fraternal, are not liable for any damage out arising, providing previously owned eyeglasses or hearing aids to a person if the person is at least 14 years of age. The eyeglasses or hearing aid are provided to the person without charge. The immunity provisions of subsection 1 of this section applies to eyeglasses only if the eyeglasses are provided by a licensed optometrist or ophthalmologist who has personally examined the person who received the eyeglasses and issued a prescription for eyeglasses, or personally consulted with a licensed optometrist or ophthalmologist who issued the prescription for the eyeglasses. That is just applies to eyeglasses, doesn't apply to hearing aids or other medical devices.
Thank you. And I've talked to some other people, and there seemed to be agreement that the Dash 4 was the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2312. And are you still eating lunch?
Representative Tomei moves the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2312. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Thank you.
Rest in round.
Close the work session on House Bill 2312. Open a work session on House Bill 2463. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2463 comes in from Representative Gelser. You have three sets of amendments in front of you. I believe Representative Gelser was going to ask if we consider for us the Dash 3 amendments. What this bill currently, the law requires a person who does photographs, whatever, to report if they believe the visual recording is being provided, a process involved sexual conduct of a child. And then it applies to both commercially or private, the person who's in commercial business of doing it, or actually also private. What has happened in this area, as we've seen in other bills, technology has got ahead of the law, so chair members of the committee, and a lot of the stuff appears in computers. The original bill requires a computer technician, a processor of photographic images acting within the scope of his or her employment, there's reason to believe he or she has observed an image of a child involved in sexually explicit conduct to report the fact to the cyber trip line at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Department of Human Services, or law enforcement in the county where the image was observed. Chair members of the committee, the Dash 3 amendments, if you go to the bill, would say on line 14, the processor of photographic images, and it remove for compensation, which would be going back up to the remove language, and so it would be both commercially or privately. It wouldn't mean that you were being paid for it, so long as you were doing it, develops, process, reproducts, transfers, et cetera, photographic images. And then down in line 17 and 18, it's a processor of photographic images, and we're removing while acting within the scope of the employment of the profession, once again going back above to probably tie into the current law and privately. As chair members of the committee, it basically leaves those provisions in place as it relates, at least for compensation for the computer technician. So it will be treating a computer technician different than a processor of photographic images. And I think that's to address the issue of, say, a person, a father fixing his son's computer or family member's computer and running across something that, and then putting them in the position of having to report it. So we're talking about as someone who would, as it relates to a computer technician, for compensation. That's the difference between that and the person in photographic images.
to dash threes.
So this would be somebody, Representative Olson, for example, was taking, some neighbor said, take a look at my computer, and he finds, although he'd be, because we're in legislature, mandatory reports, but if he wasn't, if he was just a neighbor, and a neighbor sees that, he does not have to report that?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. He's not doing it for compensation. That question would be, yes.
Okay. I don't know about this.
And that's Representative Geltzer's bill?
Yeah.
Maybe Mr. Chairman, this is her bill. These amendments that were put together by gentleman in the back. I'm trying to think. Maybe he should come up.
Oh, okay. Grant Wolf.
Grant Wolf. And these are the amendments that he got. I think it's intended to address the dichotomy with the technician operating. You know, what is a technician? It means a person who repairs, installs, or otherwise services a computer or a computer network. Does that mean someone, a family member who's doing that kind of work? Does that make them a technician?
Go ahead, please.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and we asked for this bill, and Mr. Taylor is exactly correct. The fear that we talked about at the first hearing was that anybody looking at a computer, that person could be a minor themselves, working on a computer and addressing some issue. And the law, I think the fear was that the law shouldn't compel that person, potentially a minor, to be a mandatory reporter. So that was kind of the fear.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Schaffer.
So are they now? So we're just saying they're not, even though they're not now? What are we changing here? If they're not mandatory reporters now.
Committee, Representative Schaffer, the law currently applies to the Kodak situation, where you took a picture and brought it down to Kodak to have it processed. I don't think you could find a Kodak place now to process pictures. It's now into the computer age, and not only talking about a processor of photographic images, but a computer technician who's working on a computer.
But let me get this right then, Mr. Chair. So if I'm a computer technician, I'm getting paid to fix a computer, I have to turn them in if they can find stuff on their computer. But we're saying if they're not getting paid, they don't. But I'm a legislator, and I'm on duty now, and I'm a mandatory reporter. When I'm off duty, I'm still a mandatory reporter. So I don't know. I feel uncomfortable with this. I guess I'll just say that.
Yes.
This bill, it clarifies what's already existing federal law. Computer technicians have to, they're mandatory reporters now under federal law, and they also are under state law. But, and the reason for the bill, that we brought the bill, there are some liability protections under the federal law that aren't, they don't exist under state law. So we're clarifying that they have to report, just like they do under federal law, and that they have the same liability protections that they have under federal law. The issue that we're amending here today happened because if you look at the bill, legislative council inadvertently indicated that photo processors would no longer have to report if they weren't doing it for compensation. So this amendment basically takes it back to the way it was. It's not, there's not a substantive change regarding computer technicians.
Yeah. The idea that behind the computer technician protection is, for example, if Representative Hicks was working on a lot of child abuse cases, he might have that in there, and he needs some repair work done, and you don't know why he has those in there, so then you'd report, right. Well, he can't sue you. Right. It gives you
protection. I'm with you. Right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Wolf.
You bet.
Be it put back in if somebody's using darkroom film, which nobody does anymore, but just in case. Okay. Is there a motion to accept the Dash 3 amendments?
Moved.
Representative Tomei moves the Dash 3 amendments. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 2463. Opening work session on House Bill 2687.
Yeah, House Bill 2687 comes to from the family law section. The Oregon State Bar requires a person ordered to pay temporary spousal support to pay the other party rather than the clerk of the court. The court administrator of the Department of Justice allows a court to include the amount of temporary child support or spousal support requested after commence a suit in the general judgment applies to proceedings commenced on or after the effective date of the act. Mr. Chairman, as a committee, you have the Dashbourne amendments in front of you, but you may want to bring Russ Lepesky up from the family law section of the bar because he's had some communication with a judge who has suggested some further changes to the language. Russ has rough language that has yet to go through Legislative Council's office, but he is sitting in the audience.
Thank you, Co-Chairs, member of the committee. I'm Russ Lepetsky, appearing on behalf of the Family Law Section, the proponents of this bill. The dash ones that you have, as Mr. Taylor recited, were to address some concerns that we had. After the dash ones were prepared, Judge Rastetter in Clackamas County had some communication, I think, with Representative Garrett, as well as with members of our group, about some additional improvements that he thought could be made to the bill. I've been working with Judge Rastetter and have, as Mr. Taylor indicated, come up with some proposed dash two amendment language. And the groups that I've been able to run this by have no conceptual objection to the change that we're looking at, though they have not reviewed this actual proposed language. That's the status.
Question for clarification. They are required before this to pay to the clerk of the court so there's a record of the payment. If this other individual, if they get paid to some other individual, then the clerk of the court, how is the record kept as to whether or not they're up on payments?
Co-chairs, the payments to the clerk of the court, that's actually a different section of the bill and not the one that is being amended, but I certainly want to respond to the question. The clerk of the court has no record-keeping function, and that's one of the reasons for this bill is to get the clerk of the court out of the loop, because even though the statute currently says payments are to be made to the clerk of the court, they never are, and the clerks of the court are not even equipped to undertake that record-keeping function if somebody were to try to make the payment to the clerk of the court. These proposed Dash 2 amendments that I hope you'll consider deal with the question of notice and the question of the payment of temporary support after a petition for dissolution is filed but before a general judgment is entered. And I can go into more detail if you want, but in short, that's what those amendments will deal with.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to need to wait. Okay, thank you very much. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2687, and we'll bring this back when we get the refined dash twos. Open a work session on House Bill 2714.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2714, Representative Tomei, a bill that creates a crime of patronizing a prostitute if a person pays or offers to pay a fee to another to engage in sexual act, classifies a crime as a Class A misdemeanor, sets a fine of $20,000 if the person to whom the fee was offered was under 18, does not require the state to prove the person to whom the offer was made was under 18, but the court determines that the defendant is unable to pay $20,000, allows the court to impose a fine that the court determines the defendant can pay, prohibits the court from waiving or suspending the fine, amends the prostitution statute so that it only applies to the person offering to engage in sex act for a fee. Currently now the prostitution statute includes both the person offering and the person making the offer.
Are there any questions about the bill?
We haven't had a fiscal statement on this either. Okay, thank you.
Okay. And if there were to be further amendments, maybe they could be done before the bill comes back.
Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2714. We'll be revisiting that. Open a work session on House Bill 3100.
Members of the committee, House Bill 3100 comes to you. It comes here from Representative Clem. What it requires a person pleading not guilty except for insanity file with the court a report from the psychiatrist, the psychologist who has been certified by the Oregon Health Authority, allows the court to report commencement of trial if the cause is not filed at court time, allows the court to only accept the plea agreement if not guilty except for insanity if it's been approved, but if the evaluation has been done by a psychiatrist or psychologist. Requires a court to commit to the state hospital a person convicted of a misdemeanor. The person is not only affected by mental disease or effect, but also presents a substantial danger to others. Otherwise, they'd be treated in the community. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Requires a person convicted convicted of Class C felony except for insanity, the defendant has been evaded by local mental health care program designated by Psychiatric Security Review Board to do the evaluation. Allows the Mental Health Authority and the Psychiatric Security Review Board to adopt rules upon under this bill. Chair, members of the committee, you have several sets of amendments in front of you. The Dash 1 amendments, basically, currently one of the primary concerns is public safety on a commitment. And best would be to look over on page 5. So it's the board show right now has its primary concern, the protection of society. This amendment would say its primary concern of the board shall be to balance the need for protection of society with treatment of the person. That's basically what this amendment would do. As chair members of the committee, you have the Dash 2 amendments in front of you, and I believe Bob Jundiff is in the audience, and Mr. Jundiff is the gentleman who requested that he represents Disability Rights of Oregon.
I don't think I have the Dash 2 for
me. I don't have it.
Mr. Jundiff, why don't you go ahead and come on up and explain that
if you want. Wait, yeah. See if I goofed up here. Thank you for.
I can just chair members of the committee. You too don't have them.
I do. I
can read them.
It was
buried.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger. My name is Bob Jundiff from Disability Rights Oregon. I'm speaking to the Dash 2 amendments. I emailed to your offices a memo that explains the purposes of the Dash 2. If you don't have it, I'll make sure that you do. Basically, this amendment was in a bill that we originally in a bill that we submitted in the same topic area. It deals with the question of people who have been found unable to aid and assist when they've been charged with a criminal offense. As you know, if a person is found unable to aid and assist, they're sent to the state hospital for restorative treatment. Under the state law, the hospital has a period of time to determine to either restore the person to competency so they go back and face their criminal charges, or determine that this person will never be restored, able to be restored to capacity and tell the court that. If the hospital informs the court that the person cannot be restored to capacity, then the court has an option of either releasing that person or moving them to a civil commitment so that they stay in a treatment environment under those civil laws. The criminal case in those situations is dismissed without prejudice, so should the day come when that charge can be relitigated. That's the law that we have now. This amendment addresses a situation that we've become aware of in which people are in jail awaiting adjudication of their criminal offense. They're found unable to aid and assist, and they go to the hospital. The hospital stabilizes their symptoms and returns them to jail to take care of their criminal charges. But while in jail, they again decompensate, go back to the hospital for more treatment, and then are returned. And we have seen cases in which people have gone back 3 and 4 times back and forth because they get stabilized at the hospital, returned to jail, destabilized, come back. In our law, it says that under any circumstances, the state has 3 years in which to get a person ready to face their charges. And if they're unable to do so within 3 years, then it's time for the court to move to the other disposition, which is civil commitment or release. The hospital has interpreted the 3-year requirement as beginning every time the person comes into the hospital. So if a person returns 3 times, the hospital's interpretation is for each new time they come back, it's another 3 years. Our feeling is that these are very rare cases, but in those rare cases, we believe that by allowing a person to essentially be indefinitely within the circulating process of going back and forth, that it would violate the constitutional principle that says that the state must restore a person to competency if they're holding on to them within a reasonable period of time, and that's been interpreted through Supreme Court adjudication being about 3 years. So we're just trying to make sure that for those rare instances that we have some finality in terms of returning a person to capacity to stand trial, or we move to the next step. That's the purpose of the amendment.
Does this amendment change any of the other, override any of the other amendments that you're aware of?
No, it doesn't. Okay. It addresses a very discreet area. We believe it's a technical fix. It really doesn't affect policy, in our view, in any way other than to clarify that three-year standard that was set out in Jackson versus Indiana.
Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Bob, help me understand. So these rare patients who might go back and forth three times and might be in as long as, say, 8 or 9 years, I'm assuming. So what would happen to them? They decompensate when they've come back to the jail. They've been in the aid and assist for 3 years. They decompensate. So then they would go and have a civil commitment? Is that what I'm understanding you to say?
Right now, when we get to the end of the three-year period, the judge is presiding over the criminal charge may refer that person for a civil commitment hearing in which there's a determination of whether the person's danger to self or others based upon a mental disorder, and if so, then the person's committed to the hospital. Or the judge can release that person to the community. That's what the law provides right now. And that's under the principle that if the government's holding on to a person's, taking custody of a person for the purpose of restoring their capacity, that the government cannot do that indefinitely. There has to be some reasonable period of time in which the government makes that effort, and if they do not succeed, then they need to move into another reason for holding on to the person. In this case, it would be civil commitment.
Thank you.
Is there further questions from the committee? Counsel?
Mr. Tindall, if you mentioned that the person goes from the hospital where they're stabilized, I assume they're on some kind of medication.
Correct.
And then they go to the jail. Doesn't the medication go with them?
Not always. Co-chairs, Mr. Taylor, sometimes jails have formularies for medications, and sometimes a person is stabilized on a particular medication in the state hospital. They return to the jail. That particular jail has a drug formulary. The drugs that the person was on in the hospital don't meet that formulary. They're taken off the medications as they had. They're put on a different medication. We've seen cases of this sort. Sometimes it can happen that a person just in the more stressful environment of a jail, they can't. The treatment that's available between the hospital and the jail may be extremely different.
I represent Jackson.
Doctor, well, how can we address that issue of the jail not abiding by the hospital's prescription? And this might be our chance to do so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I think that's a much larger question that goes outside of the bounds of this bill, because it has the responsibility for providing care in the jail is the county's responsibility, and counties handle in different ways in 36 states. There are constitutional requirements that they must meet, but so that they're not there's cruel and unusual punishment happening as a result of deprivation of mental health treatment, but there isn't any, that I'm aware of, any standardized state standard for that care.
I mean, the county is charged by the court to detain persons suspected of committing crimes and awaiting trial, and to, you know, bring them to the court at the appointed time, mind and I think body, is, you know, body and mind together. I don't think there's a real okay, so I wonder if Council could perhaps probe a little bit deeper into that, if that is a tangential area of addressing. Or
Chairman of the Committee, the bill relating clauses relating to crime. You could always, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, get an amendment and see what Legislative Council's office thinks, and then even if it's close, I'm not too sure who would challenge it being outside the scope of the bill. If that's what the theme you'd like me to work on.
It would potentially be within the relating clause of this?
I don't know. I'll find out when.
Okay.
We will find out when we request it. And
okay.
What that Legislative Council's office will do is give us an opinion whether it fits or does not fit within the scope of the relating clause.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm purely layman here, but so you get some guy in here and he's in jail and he's not balanced. We put him in the hospital. They get him squared away. He's back in the jail. He's taken off the meds that were keeping him squared away. Send him back. Now it's 3 years later, this back and forth. And now we're going to commit this guy when we know, there's evidence of the possibility of getting them balanced through the medication, but we're going to go ahead and commit him anyway. I mean, I know this, I'm not against what you're trying to do here in this bill, but you've really shed some light on something that doesn't make any sense to me, doctor, and I'm not suggesting it makes sense to you either, but I think we should try and do something about this problem. That's what I'm trying to say.
Representative Schaffler, thank you for calling me doctor. I'm a jurist doctor.
Well, then we got a few other words to call you.
But I'd be very happy to work with you on this particular problem.
All right, thank you.
And thank you, Mr. June Depp. And I'll ask counsel to work with you and to maybe see if we can't fix that. Please.
I've tried to get it done for 8 years. When I found out there's no committee come out.
Why don't you give us a heads up on the dashboard?
Sure, members of the committee, we have the dashboard amendment, which come to us from Oregon NAMI. They're very extensive. They are before you. I would suggest that we have Chris Bonhoff, NAMI, and Dr. Wendy Borg, Ransford, for discuss the amendments. I mean, if you look at them, they no later than 60 days after receiving notice described in subsections that the board shall, after hearing, order the person conditionally released subject to supervisory orders of the board. Chairmen of committees, these are a definite departure from the current way of the process operates.
Okay. Who are the names?
I have difficulty with the pronunciation. I think maybe Laura Smith may be able to help us. Chris Bornoff?
If you bring your group up, then we'll...
Dr. Wendy Borg-Ransford? I think that's it.
Looks like it's me.
Yeah.
Hi, thank you. Please go ahead, either one. Identify yourself for the record and help us understand the dash force, please.
Sure. My name is Chris Bonf. I'm the executive director of NAMI Oregon, and unlike Bob, I didn't have the foresight to email a memo on this, so you'll be receiving a hard copy of it. The summary of what we're trying to do in this amendment is on page 2 of that. And I'm going to leave the two major sections are section 11 and 12. I'm going to start with section 12 because I think that's makes sense in terms of why section 11, a clock starts ticking, and as Mr. Taylor said, there's a departure from the way it's currently done. What happens now is when someone is given into the custody of Oregon State Hospital, the processes are not in place to introduce assessments and risk treatment planning, risk assessments, clinical assessments in any kind of timely and thoughtful manner. Any other hospital would be doing those almost upon admission. Our practice has not been that at Oregon State Hospital. We haven't had adequate treatment plans. We have people that go sometimes years in extreme cases without both an assessment and a treatment plan. And so what we've tried to do in Section 12 of our amendments is introduce procedures, very simple ones, very measurable procedures that begin to hold the hospital accountable on a time frame. So when someone is admitted to the state hospital, they do receive those elements that we know lead to good quality clinical care, and that there's regular progress and measurement of progress on clinical goals so that someone does get better while in the hospital's care, and someone is measuring that progress so they can make adjustments. Once they have made that progress and discharge planning starts to occur while they're still in the hospital, that leads up to Section 11, is that the hospital, again, using standardized assessment tools that all people in the system have agreed to, that these are the tools we're going to use, these are accurate measurements of people's progress clinically and also their risk to community and also to themselves, that the hospital then notifies the PSRB that a patient has substantially met or has completely met all their clinical goals and no longer requires hospital-level care. Once that notification occurs, that there is a time frame upon which a release occurs, so someone is not languishing in the hospital well beyond the time they've received maximum benefit from that level of care. And so this is all intended, as we testified last Friday, when we all gathered together, is that as 3100 as it stands now does a good job, we believe, of screening people on that front door end. And what we're trying to do in these amendments is, again, make sure that folks who are there at the hospital now and those who will be placed there in the future receive maximum benefit from their stay there and don't stay beyond the time that they need, so that we're not spending that $200,000 per bed year on someone who doesn't need that level of care, and again, opening up that precious resource.
Chairman, I understand currently right now the decision to release someone is with the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, sure. Yes.
And under your bill, would that be switched to the state hospital?
That's a question I may have to defer to a little brighter mind than mine, but the intention is that, again, we've come to an agreement, and later in the amendment you'll see that there is a process by which all stakeholders in consultation, the Oregon Health Authority, PSRB, the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board, agree upon clinical assessment tools so that as people progress, there isn't this lack. We have ambiguity in the system now, and what happens is you have a hospital not fulfilling its duties, and sometimes even when it does, it gets to a hearing process, and there's not agreement over what is being said clinically and risk-wise by an individual. And what we want to do is get rid of that ambiguity. So it's very clear up front, as someone is meeting their clinical goals, that as they get to the discharge process in that system, that a discharge actually occurs, that we don't necessarily have to have a hearing at which the facts are in dispute as to someone's risk to community and also to their mental health status. In terms of, you know, answering the questions about those tools, our good doctor here can certainly address that much more ably than I can.
I can also address a little bit of the process. I conduct evaluation.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, Dr. Wendy Berg-Ransford, I'm a psychologist. I conduct evaluations for the PSRB right now. And the way the system is currently set up, it's the evaluation occurs kind of near the end of the game. And oftentimes, the evaluation is given to the PSRB shortly before the hearing, and there's not a lot of time to consider what the patient's needs are and to have a discussion about what the patient's needs are. And I think this system would establish more of an ongoing process that would lead to better outcomes and more ability to consider over time the person's needs.
Please. Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I'm looking on the first page of the Dash 4 Amendment, Section 11, and my reading of the section, and I recognize that that you're not the legal sort of authority, but I do have to ask the question of the witnesses. My reading of the section is that this does, in fact, transfer ultimately the release decision, the authority from the PSRB to the superintendent of the hospital, because Section 11, Paragraph 2A specifically says no later than 60 days after receiving the notice, which is generated by the superintendent, the board shall, PSRB shall, after hearing, order the person conditionally released, subject to the supervisory orders of the board, best interest of justice, etc. That's my reading of it, and that's ultimately transferring the release decision to the superintendent of the hospital from the PSRB. That's what I'm reading.
Again, Representative Hicks, I'm not the legal branch of our organization,
okay. But
what we're attempting to set up is a rational and predictable system that by the time someone is ready for release, that all parties agree they're ready for release.
Correct.
So you have agreement on tools and assessment pieces, and you have constant treatment planning and constant communication. And as you see later in the bill, what we're trying to establish is more communication between the hospital and the PSRB, and that notification should occur when someone has substantially met most of their clinical goals, and that discharge planning occurs. So by the time you get to the point where the hospital says this person no longer needs to be here, that there, again, there's no ambiguity that someone needs to be there. If there is a risk, again, the question then is, that I would pose is that the hospital is not the appropriate place for them. Because if it's not a clinical need, and again, you have this precious resource, then placement should occur and their discharge should happen, but it should be to an appropriate placement, and the hospital would not be that place.
And can I comment as well? I can't comment on how it is written or what it is actually implying legally, but what I would hope it would imply is that the clinical assessment is done at the hospital with some risk parameters outlined, but the PSRB would be a good decision-making body to help assess the risk level to the community, and that judicial body needs to make the decisions about how to minimize the risk to the community and how to monitor and supervise. So there's the clinical aspect, and then there's the community safety aspect, and the partnership needs to occur between the PSRB and the hospital to, I think, provide both levels of care. The care to the community in terms of risk, and the care to the individual in terms of improving their mental health.
May I follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, okay, it's good to know what the intent is here. And Section 12, from my quick review of it and your description, does reflect that. That doesn't, to my reading, transfer the release authority. I mean, that simply, you know, gives a notice to the PSRB, and also does require the PSRB to take some action to assign a caseworker. I mean, that sort of thing sounds like it's right in line with what you're trying to accomplish, but I do have to watch the language we have to watch the language very carefully.
Absolutely.
So, and that would be, I think you would recognize a massive shift in our approach to, you know, mental health within the criminal justice system if we were to shift that decision-making over to the superintendent of the hospital. So Section 11, right now, I'm not real comfortable with.
Well, I mean, we're happy to have discussions about appropriate language and getting us to where we need to be, which is using the hospital as a hospital and not a correctional institution or a warehouse, which is currently its status, unfortunately.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Because I was looking at the relating clause. Relates to crime, creating new provisions, la 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 la. So actually this, I want Bill to hear this. So I guess my question is to you, Bill. It seems to me that the points that are being made here are very interesting. But I'm wondering if this wouldn't be appropriate to be a separate bill, because does this fit within the relating clause? Whereas LC already decided that it does.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Tomei, we did not receive a memo from Legislative Council's office saying that this exceeded the relating clause. So my assumption is that it does fit within the bill.
Okay.
So,
right. It seems like in working with several people on this over. May I continue with this line, Mr. Speaker?
Yes.
Mr. Chair. That we had certain goals and parameters.
That's right.
And it seems like this goes beyond those, which is not to say this isn't absolutely appropriate, but I'm wondering if it would not be more appropriate to have it be a separate piece of legislation.
You don't need to answer.
I just am stating that. I guess I was asking Bill because he's worked with us on this.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a policy issue. I can understand. I was working with you on this.
Right.
Issues and other bills with work groups, and the primary issue that we were addressing was the psychiatrists and psychologists being certified, and then the issue of misdemeanors and others being treated more in the community than in the state hospital.
Right. And
so this does, as a policy matter, considerably broader.
Right.
But it does legally fit within the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. And then why doesn't the other scenario, that when the lawyer was up here, fit in within the bill too? Because we're talking about the psychiatric health welfare of this patient, and what you're considered a patient who happens to be a criminal.
Correct.
It's an interesting conversation. Probably not going to solve it today, but if this fits in, why doesn't the other one fit in? Anyway, for what it's worth.
Okay, thank you very much.
I understand. This is about
Richard,
mental
you got to come up and talk about timelines?
Yeah.
So,
My name is Richard Harris, and I'm the Administrator for Addictions and Mental Health on the Oregon Health Authority. And if I may, I just wanted to make a couple of brief comments about this. We have not seen the amendments. We've seen the concept draft that was provided by NAMI last week. And we would like an opportunity to sit down with the authors of the amendments to discuss what amongst those amendments actually apply to the hospital in certain ways. So at the present time, the hospital has a number of evaluations and treatment plans that patients go through that are in fact done in a timely manner and are required by Joint Hospital Accreditation Standards, which the hospital meets. So some understandings about the way the hospital goes about doing its business. I don't believe it's fair to characterize the hospital as not doing treatment plans nor doing assessments or evaluations, which in fact we do on a regular basis. So I would like an opportunity to sit down at some point. I think we're talking about early next week to go through those amendments with NAMI and the others who have joined in to offer the amendments.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During the course of that discussion, I mean, a lot of people have visited me along the way of this, and we've had a lot of productive conversations, and Dr., you know, we've had one as well. And I just would like it if at the end of that discussion someone could come back and explain to the committee where mental health should be going long range, what, you know, the public health kind of approach, what is our macro approach, what is our goal, and how is this approach going to get us there? What this is, people keep saying this is a step in the right direction. What direction are we going in? I've never had that answered. I mean, someone out there who's not just thinking purely in fiscal terms has got, I mean, some psychiatrist somewhere has got a study and says, you know, public health, this public health question should be addressed in this particular way. If someone could come back next time and introduce us to that, that would be extremely useful to this process.
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, I would be more than happy to have that conversation because I think it's an important aspect of what we're trying to do here, and that there are tie-ins to the proposed legislation that would, in fact, provide better mental health services to people, and I think we should have that discussion. So if you just name the time and place, I'd be glad to be there.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 3100. I'm sorry, House Bill 3100. And we will do some more work before we get this done. We'll get that all straightened out. And as a reminder, next Friday.
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Next Friday, the committee will be taking a tour of the Oregon State Penitentiary down the street. Is there any further business coming before the committee? Meeting adjourned.